This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about environment law. I am here today with barrister Mr. Sailesh Mehta from Red Lion Chambers in London. Sailesh is a senior barrister who prosecutes and defends in high-profile, complex and law-defining environmental cases, and he regularly advises the Environment Agency at a national level. Sailesh also lectures other lawyers and judges on aspects of environmental law, both in the UK and abroad. Thank you for joining us, Sailesh.
My pleasure.
Excellent. Great stuff. So, let's get to our first commonly asked question about environment law. And I think, Sailesh, we've really got to start from the top, because until I sort of heard certain aspects of this area, I didn't realise that there was such an expansive area of law assisting us in this you know, sector. So what do we mean by when we say environment law? What are environmental laws and regulations? What does that mean?
These are just simply a series of rules that are designed to protect the environment. These rules can be local regulation that only affects the locale that a person lives in, borough-wide rules. They can be national rules, legislation, or they can be international rules in terms of treaties or European-wide regulations. So it's a conglomeration, it's a mixture of rules all interweaving with each other, designed to protect every aspect of our valuable environment.
Yes, yes. Okay, well, that's very clear and very nicely put, as it were. So when we say, okay, there's laws that protect the environment, which is brilliant, obviously, what types of areas of commonly known environmental law would you say exist? So what's the most common areas of environmental law?
I can answer that question in two ways. One, to look at the wider aspect. So the wider aspect of what environmental law covers is everything. Now, I know that's right. Not a helpful definition.
So the headlines. Let's start, for example, with the headlines. So, yes. Like the Clean Air Act, yes. For example. What are the headlines, the main ones?
So the main headlines would be, and when I say everything, I mean air. The air we breathe is covered by environmental law. And so the Clean Air Act is an example of one of the myriads of laws that regulate how the air we breathe is protected by the country we live in, by our legislation, but also internationally. The water we drink, the Water Resources Act, for example, deals with the quality of water we drink.
Which is quite interesting, and I just want to say on that point, I mean, I tend to think of the big company, you know, for example, Thames Water, and you think, oh, whatever they provide is actually correct. But there's laws that actually protect us if we don't think it's correct, for example.
Oh, yes. Every glass of water, every cup of tea or coffee that we drink that contains water is seriously regulated. Going back 200 years, people were dying in this country of badly produced water.
Yes, indeed.
And therefore, it is seen as one of the fundamental rights that we have to make sure that the drinking water we get is clean, that it's not going to harm us or our children.
And not necessarily rely on the company that's providing you your drinking water. You can take a view and say, this, something here doesn't feel right. And we're not scientists. Everyday people don't sit there and are not able to perhaps analyse, but sometimes you can see whether the air you're breathing, whether the water you're drinking, and this is obviously at the very basic level, something's not quite right.
Exactly. You know? And of course we can see that not just in this country, but all over the world.
Yes.
There are cases going in America of companies like Thames Water who have been providing bad quality water, and it's had an effect on not only the immediate people in that area who are drinking, but also the next generation of children who've been affected allegedly by bad quality water.
And then, you know, that brings me to think of the Erin Brockovich film. And I know I mentioned this to you when we were speaking on the phone a few weeks ago. You know, the water was being contaminated by local corporate companies. And actually, a lot of people suffered some serious, because that was a true story, the Erin Brockovich story, played by Julia Roberts, the film, suffered some serious consequences as a result. Yeah. So it is down to us, really, I guess, to say, does something feel wrong here? Is it, you know, is this okay? And then there's really, what we're saying is, there are lots of rules and laws that can protect us.
And this is part of the natural tension and the necessary tension between large companies who have a job to provide us, for example, with good drinking water, who want to save as much money as they can in the process so that their shareholders make money.
Or things can sometimes go wrong.
Or things go accidentally wrong. And the other tension is that the job of government is to regulate it and to protect us. And, of course, the individual, you and I, come into the picture, because when we see that there are things wrong, then we need to alert the authorities. We need to talk to the water company to make sure that they're doing it correctly. And if those natural tensions are calibrated properly, then you get the best of all worlds, where a company can make enough money for its shareholders and do its job and provide the water that we want, and we are kept health and safe.
Or keep the air clean around its factories, or dispose of its waste in a safe and responsible way, and all that sort of stuff. So we've got the Clean Air Act, we've got the Water Act. What other topical headings would you say are the most commonly thought of when we think of environment law?
Well, one of the biggest areas is particularly to do with the West is our production of waste. And the production of waste has grown exponentially. And so over Christmas, we will know that the Christmas presents we've had, just the wrapping
paper and the bows and the glitters and all of
and
that.
And the food that we've wasted and the bits of turkey that go in the bin. Now, imagine that multiplied from your household into 20 million households, and then imagine that multiplied Europe-wide into 100 million households.
Well, it's huge. It's really big numbers. And I mean, I think we're only now, in the last few years, becoming aware of this whole, you know, since plastic bags were not being given anymore and more sold. And I think it was 600 million bags of plastic bags, apparently, were saved in the first year alone, or some number like that that I saw in a statistical place. But one of the things that pricks my eyes up is when, shopping centres and they've got these big silver bins. On there it says zero waste to landfill. And I always think, well, what does that mean? And, does it mean they recycle everything that we put in there?
That was the hope. It would be unlikely that the average bin can be recycled 100%. But the good news is that over the last 20, 30 years, the technology has developed so much and the law protecting the environment has developed so much, working hand in hand, that in fact the big companies such as Biffaway, such as the waste companies that I sometimes have to deal with, are getting better and better at making sure that less and less goes into the underground,
gets
buried, because there it just stays sometimes for a long time, and sometimes, and this is rare, it actually then continues to pollute the earth and also the water, the aquifers underneath the environment. And so one of my cases involved the pollution of an underground waste site that was leaking into an underground water source.
That's going into domestics and obviously corporate health. One of the most interesting facts on how items of plastic or wood and glass I saw was actually at the Science Museum, along with my children. And I thought, wow, look at that. I was actually ignorant to the fact that plastic takes how long to actually disintegrate?
Oh, it takes hundreds of thousands of years to disintegrate.
And I never would have known that. And I think that we really need to educate ourselves more on these basics.
Oh, more worryingly, that the latest research on the fish that we eat, that are fished in parts of the sea,
a large percentage are full of plastic.
Yeah, microscopic plastic in parts of the sea where the sea on the face of it is pristine. And so where some of the fish are fished, you wouldn't even dream that plastic would have infiltrated
that
deep
extent.
And that far. And even the rainwater, latest analysis of rainwater in some parts of the world, suggests similar microplastics are getting to the rainwater. And so the level of pollution that we are experiencing is unprecedented in the history of the planet.
It's very topical now. I mean, it's actually going into the mainstream news. There's more programmes, more documentaries about it. And I think there really needs to be, because it's great having the environmental law there, but if we don't know that we could use it and how it can protect us and protect our environment, then it, you know, it's a bit sort of in the background. And it has been, certainly in my life, for many years, and it's only the last few years through
And you're not unusual. Even judges thought exactly the same as you. So 30 years ago, when I started dealing with environmental law, it was seen as a backwater, esoteric area of law. And occasionally, I'd take a case into the Crown Court and a judge would say, why is this case in my criminal court? Now, you don't get judges saying that, because environmental law has become mainstream because it is all pervasive and the importance of it has become more and more commonly accepted.
Yes, no, and I completely appreciate that. I mean, you know, it's a big, big area, and I'm really pleased we're doing this podcast, and this has certainly been an informative time for me whilst researching how we're going to put this podcast together. And then we go on to other questions, because obviously we've had the big, one of the biggest tragedies of you know, recent time, being the Grenfell Tower. And as a fire law specialist, when something like the Grenfell Tower happens, how does this relate in any way to environment law? You know, how does that relate to that? Because, you know,
It relates in a number of ways. And you may know I've been involved in advising a number of fire brigades all over the country, partly as a result of the Grenfell outfall. So the obvious way that a large fire affects the environment is, of course, the smoke.
And
people didn't know before Grenfell became front page news that, of course, a building, most buildings, have a huge number of pollutants in them. And if you set light to them in unusual circumstances, such as Grenfell, and particularly when the heat is above a particular temperature, then the pollution instantly not only gets into the atmosphere and therefore potentially into our lungs, but also when it comes down, as it did in Grenfell, the 400 yard area around was contaminated, and therefore the topsoil had to be taken away in some areas because it was just too contaminated to be safely walked on
so
or played on.
So if you're a resident, you know, which of course there's lots of residents living around the Grenfell Tower, and all this stuff is now, apart from the big tragedy of what actually just happened, you know, it falls into your garden. You've got your, I don't know, your herbs and vegetables in there, or your children are playing out there, or your pets, your dog, your cats are out there. You know, what do you do? Who do you, where do you go to make somebody aware that this shouldn't happen? And someone needs to deal with it.
That there is a cascade of problems when something like this on such a large scale happens. But on the individual level, the first port of call would be the local authority to contact them. The environment agency would be also your port of call. The fire brigade, who are well used to dealing with environmental concerns, would
really?
Also...
Really? Because I thought that the fire brigade actually only dealt with emergency fires, fires. So, would they be a point of
contact? They may not be able to solve your immediate problem, but they will then put you on to
It's a helpful start, isn't it? Because that's what you want. You want to know where to start.
And,
so that's very interesting. So if, you know, if you do, for example, notice something that's not right in your back garden or whatever, you can contact the fire brigade and say, right, this is my problem. Who would be the best person, department?
Absolutely, and that is necessary. And in fact, a number of pieces of legislation that are now on the statute books came about because a local resident or a local residents group thought, this isn't right, we need to do something about it. And then they contact the local authority, who say, not our problem. The environment agent says, well, it's not on the statute books. They contact the local MP, who says, well, we need to get... And then suddenly it becomes much more important, and then it gets into the law in a year or two time.
Well, like you mentioned earlier, with the judges now having a better understanding, and it's all sort of now frontline law rather than sort of an area of law which is quite in the background of our lives, that this is, you know, there are places to go, there is somewhere to start when there's issues. But it's very interesting, because I would have never in my mind thought of the fire brigade to call them unless there was a genuine emergency and a fire going on. And it's and therefore, this area of law must be incredible. In this particular last 5-10 years alone, Salish, I would say that it must have been really active with new stuff coming up.
Oh, absolutely. And part of the reason for the activity is, firstly, members of the public are becoming much more aware of how they are being assaulted in the air, in the water. And also they're becoming more aware of their rights. And that's why lawyers like me are kept busy, and judges now do not say, why is this case in my court? They say, what can I do to stop it?
Yes.
Just a small example, when I was prosecuting Thames Water, in a small court in Aylesbury, you'd expect that no one would come to listen. The whole of the public gallery for the 5 days I was there was full of local residents.
Wow.
I wanted to understand what was happening to their water, what the judge was going to do, and whether this would be allowed or stopped.
And was it resolved in favour of your client?
This was, so I was prosecuting for the Environment Agency.
Yes.
And as you know, Thames Water is a multi-billion pound company.
Yes, indeed.
The biggest, and they pleaded guilty to, over a number of years, allowing sewage to go into the River Thames and its tributaries.
Well, you wonder why our River Thames is so mucky and hot and the sea around us, it's so dirty. It just feels so dirty, doesn't it?
Yes.
Particularly the River Thames.
Oh, this was billions of litres of sewage that was allowed to go into the river. But on a positive note, I should say, the River Thames has not been as clean as it is now. Compared to 200 years ago, when you could not find signs of life other than microorganisms that lived
on the people
in
the boats that were going up and down the river.
Or microorganisms that feasted on the feces and so on.
Wow.
Now you get fish in the river.
When did that stop then, Sage? Do we even know when people like Thames Water, for example, stopped throwing rubbish into the into the Thames? When did that stop?
To be fair to the big companies, in fact, they've been fairly good compared to all other companies. It was really the people that were allowed to do it. And so we had a poor sewage system 200 years ago.
Yes, that they've inherited as a corporate, as a business.
Exactly.
So which I can totally understand. Yeah.
So Parliament, which lies almost on top of the River Thames, at times in the old days, couldn't sit. The legislators could not sit because of the stench of the sewage coming down the river. And so you'd think that was a great incentive.
That's an interesting reason to have a day off.
Exactly. But also a good reason to control this, because it was absolutely clear to ordinary people as well as our legislators that something had to be done. But it took a number of years. And so the biggest changes have happened probably in the last 50 years. And therefore the large companies who are entrusted to protect the water in this case are actually by and large doing a pretty good job.
Yes, because they're reinvesting actually to change, as we said earlier, a system that they've inherited as a corporate, which is great, because then you talk about corporate responsibility and these sorts of things coming to mind.
And so one of the biggest engineering projects that at the moment is taking place in London, apart from the HS2 project, is in fact a huge mega sewer that's being built, so that the next 50 years are going to be catered for rather than having a crumbling, ageing sewage system.
Yes.
And that's, of course, a key to a safer drinking supply as well.
No, absolutely. I mean, very interesting stuff. And actually, I watched a documentary not so long ago where they were showing that one of the sewers was full of fat, cooking fat. Now, again, that we tend to think,
burns,
I guess.
I think they're called,
Well, this thing was the size of a house, these fat deposits in these gigantuous tunnels. Yes. And again, I get naturally, I think we say, oh, the corporates, it's the corporates. But you're right in saying that individual households, where does the fat, your chips fat, your whatever you fried and cooked, where does that fat all go? Into the sink. That's what we've known to do.
Yes.
And then these fat deposits create issues. And then that creates bigger issues and wider issues.
And so it's at individual level that responsibility also
starts.
That we
need to start, yeah.
And the judge in the Thames Water case in Aylesbury actually said that during the sentencing process, that he wasn't just blaming the company, and the company was given a record fine in that case, but he also said, every household has a responsibility. If you've not eaten it, don't put it down the sink. All the tissues
it's
and the
waste. I was just going to mention
beyond.
Baby wipes, because since having children a few years ago, that all came to my attention, because naturally you would flush them. But they're not flushable. And it's only in recent years, I think, that the baby wipe packets are now saying do not flush, because it never used to be on there before.
But in fact, that was part of the problem
in
the Thames Water system, not being able to filter out the detritus that comes into their system. And things like baby wipes actually clog it up.
Yes,
and
massively.
Once it gets
I didn't
clogged
realise
up,
how much.
Yeah. And so we all have a responsibility. And of course, that requires a bit of training, a bit of knowledge. And luckily, yes, kids at school are learning this and teaching their parents.
Yes, yes. No, that is certainly where we need to start the education, I think, at school. But as well as taking it upon ourselves, you know, I've become so stringent now about recycling my plastic, yes, after seeing what I've seen on the open news. But okay, so let's move on to another question, and that is, what would a typical environmental crime that a domestic household could be carrying out, even if they are not aware of it? So we're saying now that environmental law falls into the criminal courts.
Yes.
So what would be an example of a typical crime that as a household you could be committing, yes, under environmental law, that, and you're not even aware of it?
So a number of local authorities all over the country have local legislation that say you must sort out your bin between green waste and non-green waste, by way of example. Some areas, in fact, have three or four bins, as my area in
yes,
North London
mine
did.
Does, yes.
And so that was the starting point. And then in some boroughs, it's actually become local legislation to say this will be a criminal offence if you don't do it. Because that
fine,
was a carrot and the stick, and
yeah,
there's a fine.
Yeah.
It's rarely prosecuted, that sort of offence, but the fact is it is on the local statute books. So there's an example of how
yes,
people who are regularly not sorting
who
out their waste.
Who just don't care and yes, think, well, I don't care, I'll just chuck all the plastic yes, and all the cardboard and all the, you know, everything yes, into one
yes,
pot. But
and the system is as strong as its weakest point, which is why there was a need for that sort of legislation. So there's an example. Another example is on Guy Fawkes Night, for example. You
I
might
was just
have,
going to
have
say
a bonfire.
Burning, yes.
And so burning itself, you need to make sure that you're not putting plastic in, that you're using only certain types of waste for your fire, and you could come a cropper in a breach of national legislation if you put the wrong thing in your fire or if your fire's too big.
And is there a certain time? Because I've always wondered about this, because my family, my father particularly, you know, he'd really give the garden a real sort out at least once a year and then pile it all up and burn it in the evening.
Yes.
He always said to me, after 6 o'clock.
Yes.
After 6 p.m.
Yes.
Is that the case? You're only allowed to burn things in your garden after 6 p.m.?
That's the recommendation. And again, it depends on local law. Certainly nationally, there's no legislation about the timing of the burning.
Oh.
But the rationale for it is at least people are indoors by and large and therefore don't have to breathe
that's
in your burnt waste.
Yes.
And particularly school children.
And worry that there's
indoors.
Something's
exactly,
been set alight.
Exactly.
Now, that's very interesting. So 6 p.m. is not actually, all these years I believe that you can only light rubbish up in your garden and garden rubbish really
yes,
after 6 p.m. but it's not
yeah,
it's literally recommended that
it
you
is,
that you do
it is.
Okay, so what are the most common penalties, would you say? And I know this is a big question because it depends
yes,
what kind of, you know,
yes,
crimes we're talking about for breaching the environmental law for individuals.
Sure.
What's the most commonly seen okay, penalties and the most regular? I mean, we spoke about rubbish and we're saying it doesn't really go that far as to
sure,
for there to be a criminal charges to be pressed, but what would you
yes,
say is the most common penalties okay, for individuals and for businesses?
Sure. So I'll give you firstly an idea of the scale by giving you the lowest of the scale and the highest,
yes,
and then calibrate the scale in that way. So a common individual offence might be littering. And that would be a breach of a local bylaw, local legislation, and you might end up with a £10 to £100 fine. So fairly low in the scale. At the other end of the scale would be a massive pollution incident, so the one I prosecuted, where there was a record £20 million fine.
An individual?
That was for a company.
For a corporate,
company.
Yes.
When I prosecuted an individual for exporting horrible waste abroad, he was fined, he was imprisoned, in fact, to
for
7 years.
For business purposes or what?
It was a large-scale export of, this was electronic waste that was being exported to Africa.
Wow.
And so millions of TVs from here and also in
and
Europe.
And just dumping
being,
them into Africa.
Yeah. And the odd thing is that it's not actually per se unlawful to export a TV because developing countries not only want the TVs but are useful.
Yes,
and therefore it saves,
apart,
exactly,
parts,
and it saves
yeah,
the used parts from being buried underground here.
Yes.
But the proviso is you can only export if it's a working item. And what was happening here is that non-working TVs, what would otherwise be complete and utter waste, which we have a duty to deal with and dispose of environmentally in this country, were just being packaged and sent abroad, pretending to be working TVs.
For disposing purposes.
And the majority of it would be sent to, say, a market in Ghana or in Lagos, and there'd be amazing technicians who could use the parts, etc., to make TVs work. But a good proportion of it would end up on a heap that would then be burnt. And so you can imagine the local environmental damage. Children in Ghana, villages in China, where surveys have been done, where carcinogenic levels are increased, cancer levels, health levels for the poor in that area. And it's usually the poor who are dealing with burning of the waste and trying to salvage the scraps. All of the health in those areas have significantly taken a downturn, and therefore it needs to be stopped, and therefore prosecutions like that are designed to stop it.
Seven years imprisonment. Criminal offence.
Yeah.
And you just think, you know, that could all be avoided if they just set up a system here that allowed them to sort that out, to say, yes, right, this works, or yes, seems like it's working, and this really doesn't work.
Yes.
But
yes,
the selfishness and the mindset of the individual just said, no, I'll just ship it all out and let them deal with it. I just want the money for it on the back of a business, really.
If he'd done it properly, he would have done our economy good. He would have helped the environment by doing it properly.
Yeah.
And the £2 million that we managed to get back off him, he would have kept
so
a good proportion.
Wow, so they must have made a lot of money doing
huge
this,
amount,
you know, but in a selfish and an unresponsible
Yes.
Wait, Salish, this has been very, very, very helpful, very useful, I have to say, as a part one. And I just don't feel like we've had enough time at all, to be honest with you. But thank you very much once again for joining us. Don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcast. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. And thank you very much for listening.